Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 and by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And for the calendar, encourage you to go to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website and check that out. There's just a plethora of things that are going on down here that are fun, exciting. We're adding new stuff. We're asking people to share stuff that they'd like to see added to our offering. So come on down and check it out. And also, we always have volunteer opportunities down here. You know, whether you're a student who's looking for some credit for volunteerism, or you're somebody who, like me, is retired and want to do some really fulfilling work with what time I have left, it's a great opportunity, great people to work with, and you can actually see your investment in other people pay off, which is the big deal for me. And today with me in the studio slash conference room is the omnipotent, ever-present Miss Denise.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Denise. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, just back from vacation, you dirty dog. Went to the beach and sat in the hot tub looking out at the ocean.
I did. It was lovely.
Yeah, I really was upset with those Facebook posts. But
yeah, you were.
Yeah, I called my sponsor and worked on that resentment. I'm okay now. So today, Denise, I want to talk a little bit about the work that's involved in recovery. And I guess I should define that because there's a few different ways of looking at the work that goes into recovery. For me, when I first got into recovery, I did it through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there were certain things that are suggested to do. Primarily, they talk about the 12 steps. You know, admitting you're alcoholic, admitting your life is unmanageable. And then it goes on to talk about the basics, which are trust God, clean house, and help others. The work that I had to do there was primarily on myself, and it's it's the same for everybody. And the work I did didn't just include doing those 12 steps, saying the appropriate prayers at the appropriate step, or being of service to the group, making coffee, cleaning ashtrays like we used to in the old days, and those type of things. I also had to work on myself in the sense of I had to get a job, because when I came in to the program, I was basically unemployable. I mean, when you're drunk 24/7, you can't hold a job. Maybe you can in some weird alternate universe, but no, for me, I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't keep it together. And so I had to work on being employable. You know, I had to get the alcohol out of my system. I had to get my head squared around to a point where I could get up early, go to work, be engaged, remember what they were talking about. And my memory took a huge hit from my drinking, and probably had something to do with the years of smoking weed as well. But you know, that was work I had to do outside of my, quote, sobriety program. And I see cases like that all the time. I had a conversation with a person today who hasn't been in recovery all that long, but they had this issue from the past, from their addiction days, that may require them to be at the mercy of the court. And it could be something as simple as making restitution. It may be a matter of having to spend time in jail and having a felony conviction on them. It could be, could end up a lot of ways, but that's the work that this person is going to have to go through. And they were really panicked. I mean, in tears, semi-hysterical. But, I was able to talk with this person and explain that, yeah, this is part of the program. And you're going to have to draw on that that inner power, that higher power that you have to keep you from being insane during this process, because you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to improve the situation by wringing your hands and being freaked out about it. Not that being freaked out about it is an unreasonable response, but I think that sound thinking and caring and looking towards the future, and making a phone call to somebody like me who's been through similar stuff is a good idea. That's the kind of things that we need to work on. I got lots of specific, but I want to hear what Denise has to say about this, because she's had experience there.
Yeah, I was going to say, so most of you know that I went through the Latah County Drug Court Program, so that's a two-year program that we work on a lot of things, getting employable and, doing all the things, getting yourself an email and good residence and cleaning up some of the stuff from the past with financial things. Because there's a lot of things that can kind of go sideways in addiction, and finances is definitely one of them. Being on time, getting a schedule and a routine, getting back into the swing of life and being productive was definitely a big part of what I was working on, what I needed to do.
Yeah, and that program really had some hard work that involved, introspection. I think you told me once about you had basically write down your faults or the things that had gone wrong and express it in front of the group.
Yeah.
Or something
so
like that.
Step one of MRT is to stand up and go over 10 things about how you affected your family and friends, your job, your community, how, if you broke the law, those kinds of things, how you affected your health, your relationships. And all of this had to be done, standing in front of the group of our peers there in that small group. And there was no excuses to anything. You weren't sharing about and this happened because of this. It was just, this is what I did kind of a thing,
Yeah, this is what I did. And, I'm taking responsibility for it. And
And it basically felt like an elephant fell off of me. So it was really good in a sense. It was very, brought a lot of anxiety and stuff like that, trying to prepare for it and giving it a couple goes before it, I got it all out, what I needed to share.
Right. And that can be,
I think that's that part of stepping out of denial kind of thing.
Yeah. Stepping out of denial and then, setting yourself up to move forward out of that state of denial. That's
owning your stuff.
The real tough part. Yeah. Owning, well, taking, being able to look in the mirror and not see Satan staring back at you. I mean, I remember people talked about it, I can't stand what I see in the mirror. And my problem was I could stand what I saw in the mirror. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, it's just me. I'm just doing my thing out here, drinking and being irresponsible and driving and showing up to work drunk and not doing my job well. And, there's the stealing and, all that kind of stuff. But, it's just me.
Yeah,
but I can look back now and go, that guy was sick.
Yeah.
He was sick.
I had all sorts of excuses and reasons for doing the things that I did each day. And, yikes.
Yeah, it can be scary. But the judge said, go do this work, Denise.
Yep.
And you went and did the work.
He did.
And that included a lot of other things too, right? Like curfews.
Oh, yes. So when you're on probation, there's all sorts of fun restrictions. And the cool thing is that I've never been one to struggle too much with, quote, people will struggle with authority.
Right.
You know, I don't know if it's because I'm a female or whatever, but I was pretty much okay with that. I mean, I was just so glad to not be in jail. I did like a month in jail, and that was kind of like one of the only times I had been in jail. And so I just didn't want to be there. So if I had to be home by 8 o'clock in the beginning, and then, you know, that extended out to like 11 and things like that, I was really okay with that. That was all right. You know, and then of course that set me up for having a more productive day the next day. Because, well, I mean, my substances were what kept me up too late before, and I wasn't doing those anymore.
Right.
So there was no reason to go to bed past 10 anyways, you know?
Right.
So to be able to be inside. I will say this, though. I feel like there was a couple things that I had in a way to my advantage. I had a family and a spouse, and so I definitely had something to come home to and people to hang out with.
Right.
Things that brought me joy. And if I forgot to get milk and I couldn't leave after 8, I did have another adult to be able to go and take care of that.
Right.
Although I still tried to plan, you know,
right.
still tried to plan things out. And that's kind of it. It's like the drug court program teaches you, you know, like be on time, be responsible, be accountable, do your work, show up for UAs and like start doing all these things, because that's a part of life is being responsible, following the law and, you know.
Really,
not
being responsible,
people.
You have to be responsible.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even a bad thing. It's actually a good thing.
Yeah, I you know, remember in my addiction, you know, I basically found a way to abdicate all my responsibilities over to whoever was around, mostly my wife, mm-hmm. You know, by just either not doing them and, I forgot to pay that bill, you know, like I have for the last 3 months. And or something as silly as just doing things wrong or poorly, and then the responsibility would get yanked away from me, you know.
Right.
And I did that stuff intentionally.
Right, because it's like, oh, you're doing it all wrong. It's like you were a kid.
Right.
In the sense, and mom was just like, oh, I'm not even going to try to re-explain this.
Right, exactly.
I'm just going to do it, get out of the way.
Right, right. And so... coming back into recovery meant I had to not only take back the responsibility to do those things like a grown man, I had to relearn basically how to do those things and how to do them right. Because you don't wipe out 30 years of addiction
right.
overnight.
Right, you don't.
And when I say addiction, I'm including all those bad habits, all those excuses you used to use, like, oh, my life's horrible, so I'm going to drink. Well, in sobriety, you can say, oh, my life's horrible, I'm just going to sit in my bedroom all day and stare mm-hmm. at the wall, or I'm
right.
just going to sit and watch TV all day you know, not participate because it's just, everything's just so awful. Or, you know, in this person that I was talking about, you know, just live in fear of the repercussions of what might or might not happen.
Right.
And you can go both ways with that. It's like, nothing's going to happen with it. And all of a sudden you hear the cell door clang behind you.
Right.
And you're like, whoa, I guess that did happen.
Yeah.
Or you can walk into the court and the judge is, look, this is a financial thing. I'm not going to put a felony on you, put a misdemeanor theft on it, you pay restitution. How much can you pay? Okay, mm-hmm. you'll pay this much a month until that's paid back. Get out of here. I don't want to see you again.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
You just have to keep stepping forward. And honestly, I mean, it's okay to cry in the bathroom and then pull yourself together after that and go do the next thing, you know?
Right.
I mean, having those emotions can be a part of it. And I found it was really, really beneficial to reach out to people and have a conversation or have them share what's going on in their life to kind of calm me down and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit ago, you were sharing about some stuff and it sounded like, it reminded me of how in my program I needed to identify the false beliefs that I had, you know, I did
right.
that in drug court and I also do that, at restoration night. But basically, you know, just thinking I could do what I wanted or whatever, you know, like thinking it's okay to break the law and stuff and get rid of those beliefs and have some actual healthy ones, replace
right.
those,
right.
you know?
False beliefs are
yeah,
a
real thing.
A weird thing.
And those can even come up in childhood where like your parent says something like, oh, you're never going to amount to anything or whatever right. it can be. Because there's definitely some that I've heard people share and some that I have. And digging those up and being like, whoa, this is, like, I was a kid and I twisted this around. And my parent was probably just upset that day.
Yeah.
You know, they might have just repeated something that they had heard from their own parent.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so, yeah.
Well, and then, you
not
know,
hanging on to those.
Confronting things that I'm a congenital liar. I mean, I just am. Not so bad anymore. But when I was a child, whatever, you know, is like, not me, it wasn't me, sort of things always seemed like the right answer. You know, how did this
point
get broken?
To your siblings?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I know I was the only one in the house, and
but
I know I wasn't supposed to be throwing the ball, so, you know, couldn't have been me, and I always did that to somehow think I was protecting myself, you mm-hmm. know, against punishment, because when I was a child, punishment, you know, was physical violence, you know, it was spankings, it was psychological torture. Go to your room, wait for your dad to get mm-hmm. home. Oh, that was the worst.
I love that psychological torture.
Oh, God. Yeah, so to unlearn that, the work that has to go into unlearning that has to do, for me, with being really uncomfortable at times. Mm-hmm. You know, if the truth is, I don't really like what's going on here, and I'm not going to participate. You know, when you're talking to a friend or a spouse who wants you to go along with something, mm-hmm. it's going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It may seem devastating. It may seem unthinkable to say yes to something like that. But sometimes if you're being rigorously honest with yourself and trying to practice, you know, a decent set of principles, you know, you have to be honest and go, no, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to talk about somebody behind their back about some horrible thing I feel or that you feel that they did to you mm-hmm. just to make you feel better than and them less than. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of complicated, but I mean, the idea being, if I lie, I'm going against my basic principles. Honesty, openness, willingness. If I can't be honest, I can't be open, and I'm certainly not willing, because I'm not even willing to be honest at that point.
Right.
So that messes up a whole bunch of stuff.
It makes me think also about, you know, the counseling work to things, or however you go about doing it, if it's, you know, recovery stuff or working with a counselor or whatever. But just identifying like different kinds of patterns or traumas, child things, adult things, and being mm-hmm. able to actually work on those and heal. That actually can be a little harder than it sounds. There's a lot of emotions that go along with that. And then also if you're, you know, changing your behaviors or your patterns with things, how you interact with people, I mean, the big change word can be really hard too. Figuring out how you're going to not affect your family members with interactions that are not good for them, you know, how you respond and the way you talk to people and stuff like that, redoing those.
Yeah. Yeah. All of these things are, you know, work on some sort of level or another. You know, it's kind of funny because normal, healthy adults don't have to deal with the same sort of emotions and history that people in recovery do, because they haven't been affected their whole life by, like, for example, you brought up trauma. I had trauma in my youth. My parents were alcoholic, so of course they didn't always make great decisions, and I forgive them for that. I mean, they were sick people. They were alcoholics, but there's still stuff in, you know, my history that I still remember, and it comes back and makes me, you know, feel weird from time to time. You know, the trauma of my dad breaking, you know, the vision of my dad breaking furniture is as clear in my mind as any thought I have. And, I can barely remember, you know, great things that happened on vacation trips. You know, it's like I can kind of remember riding down a bicycle down a volcano in Hawaii. I can remember it was fun, but I don't have the visual memory of seeing my dad screaming and yelling at my mom and then slamming his fist down and breaking a leaf on a coffee table. I mean, it's like, why does my brain hold on to that visual so tightly? And so I don't think anyone grew up, well, I'm speaking broadly, but I doubt there's anyone, any human being who grew up without some level of trauma in their life at some point or another. I mean, it may have been as simple as a fender bender where you thought you were, you know, going to die, and it ends up you just wrinkle some metal and it was loud and scary and maybe your airbag went off. And, you know, that can that could be a big deal to some people. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have battling parents or, or God forbid, a murder in your family to have some sort of trauma that's going to affect the way you behave going down the line. Now, for me in particular, I honestly believe there's a genetic component to alcoholism because I can look at my family tree and see drunks as far back as before they came to this country. By my God, there's a distillery in Scotland that carries my family name. Mm-hmm. So that kind of tells me I was doomed. And being as, you know, three out of four siblings of mine had some issues with alcohol in their lives, kind of tells me that, yeah, you know, I'm predisposed to this. But that's just the disease of alcoholism. But the side effects of alcoholism, you know, the traumas that come from a dysfunctional family, you know, a dysfunctional family in spades, I mean, with violence in the form of screaming and yelling and breaking things and punching walls and just terrifying the kids, me. So my alcoholism wasn't caused by that trauma, but it certainly wasn't helped by it. It just gave me another excuse amongst the millions that I made up, you know, rationalizations. Well, it's, you know, it's a beautiful day. You know, a drink will make it better. Oh, it's a horrible day. Well, a drink will make me feel better.
Yeah, it can be a way to cope with things, you know. Right. You take on these different kinds of things and they help us cope with different kinds of thoughts and feelings and emotions and stuff like that and memories. And it can help, I don't know, kind of push those down in a way. And I feel like that's kind of the thing in recovery. I've gotten to learn and partially re-experience because I was actually in my later 20s when I first started using, but just different ways to be able to manage life. I mean, now I can, you know, do what the person that you shared earlier did. You know, I mean, that person called you really upset and that person made a good choice by calling and talking with you. Because reaching out and talking to someone is definitely beneficial as to, you know, not going and drinking or using or something like that or any of the other things that we can do when we're upset and scared. So that was a good choice.
You know? Yeah, I think it was. You know, it's funny, we give out these, when people new come into AA, at least in the groups around here, it's not necessarily universal, but we have a little threefold 8x10 piece of paper with that has schedules all the shows all the meetings that are in the area here, and there's some other information on it. But we have one whole fold that's dedicated to for people to put their phone numbers on. So, right. You know, if a man comes in, we pass this around, and all the men in the room that are willing to take a phone call put their name and number on there. Right. I was talking with someone the other day about those things, and actually handed one to a guy, and I said, yeah, go ahead and put this in your back pocket. I said, it'll probably go through the wash, but we'll give you another one if that happens. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the thousands, literally thousands, of those lists that I've put my name and phone number on. Mm-hmm. I've maybe gotten 3 or 4 phone calls from people off those lists. You know, and then half the time they're drunk, and I just tell them, well, I'll tell you what, call me back tomorrow when you're sober, and maybe they'll call back. Sometimes not.
Yeah.
But the idea is that those numbers are there for people to use, and people don't realize that when you make a call, when this person made a call to me, it changed the tone of my whole day. It just changed the tone of my whole day. I went from, you know, thinking about what we're going to do here, thinking, did I, you know, I got to get rid of a bunch of these t-shirts, got to get them ready to go, oh, got to do this for the wife, got to do this, got to do that, and just kind of, you know, getting into that daily grind thing, that kind of mindless moving from one thing to another, and then boom, all of a sudden this thing came up that made me really work, really go to my memory bank and try to help this person work through this situation. Because in the AA book, it says, we will not want to forget the past or close the door on it, because we may be able to use some of that to be helpful to someone else. And that was the case in this thing. I mean, I had amends to make that could have wound me up in jail, but I had to make them. I had to make them.
Right.
I had to be willing to take that risk that that person was going to go, you did what? That's it. I'm calling the cops. And I said, I'll sit right here until they show up. And fortunately, that didn't happen. There were some other uncomfortable things that came out of some of those conversations. But I had to be willing to fess up to my harm and be willing to let them amend the story the way they wanted it to end. You know, and sometimes that's you're going to jail. And sometimes that's, well, you know, good for you, whatever. But, you know, if I never see you again, that'll make me real happy. And other times it's like, wow, I always thought you would be like a really great employee. If you got this under control, come back and see me in a year. If you're still sober, I'll hire you. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were things like that that really just dumbfounded me, but I had to be willing to take the risk that they were not going to turn out the way I wanted, and trust my higher power, trust God, to make sure they worked out the best for that other person. Because it's not about, oh, I'm such a bad person, you know, whip me, that, you know, that'll make me a better person. No, it's about, I screwed up. I did something terribly wrong here.
Right. I'm going to own it.
You need to tell me what I can do to make it right for you.
Yeah.
No matter how painful that is for me.
That's good.
That's good. That's part of the work.
That's good. It really is.
And then there's work too, which, you know, is an interesting part. Like I said earlier, you know, I was unemployable when I first got sober. Well, I'll say I was unemployable in my addiction. And when I first got sober, I wasn't sure what, if anything, I can do, because my previous profession was working in, you know, electronics manufacturing down in Silicon Valley in California. And that was all gone, you know, by the mid-90s when I finally got sober. That had all basically been shipped offshore, being done in China or Korea or wherever. And so I couldn't go back to that. And I made a lot of money and spent a lot of money doing that. But I had to get something going to you know, start bringing money in to the family so we could, you know, continue living indoors.
Right.
You know, and having, you know, vehicles that ran and worked and, you know, could get us to our jobs. So my sponsor said, well, you know, what can you do? And I'm like, oh, I can do this and that and the other thing. So he and I sat down and looked. There used to be this thing called newspapers, and they would have job want ads,
a
big section in the back with all these different jobs with descriptions and stuff. I think now they call it the Indeed or something like that.
It's like Indeed now, yeah.
So, you know, he just sat with me and went down the list, talked about this job. Can you do that? Well, that's a little beyond my, you know, scope. Okay. You know, what about this job? Well, it doesn't pay very much. Well, can you do the job though? Yeah. All right. Send them a resume. And we just went through the, and it wasn't like something I had never done before. I had done it many times in my life, but I was just kind of apprehensive and maybe just a more than a little bit fearful that I wouldn't be able to find something that was worthy of me. And it turns out it didn't really matter, because when I started that process, that's when I've talked about it before, when our tenant's friend told me to call, you know, his boss, because they were looking for people, and I was working the next day. Right. And it was just because I became willing to just not be afraid and just
go do something.
Find something to do, you know. You were fortunate too in that way.
Yeah, I was really lucky in the sense that my adult daughter was working somewhere and talked to the owner, and I went down and talked to that lady and basically got hired on the spot, and I actually worked there for 9 years. Yeah, and I was a good employee, honestly. It was a cool job. I'm really grateful for it. And that's mostly how I've gotten all my jobs is I think but one, when I first moved to Moscow, was by knowing someone, getting a reference. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first moved to Moscow, I had to just take a chance and go in and fill out an application and do an interview and stuff like that. But I think that might be the only job that I ever had before. And then before I struggled in addiction, I had my own business. So I was self-employed. That was something that my parents did when I was growing up. So it was something seen as being pretty normal to have your own business and stuff. And then even here, like, you know, because we did the show here and I did some things here for the recovery center, I did have some connections to knowing people. So that helped too. One of the other things that I thought of that I did in recovery that was a little work was just reconnecting with different community, you know, like not hanging out in the same community where I was using. And it was always really cool when I would see people come into the drug court program that I was in that I knew from out there. It was a good thing. I was very excited to see their faces there. But to like even now where I have good friends and good community and, you know, and good support and stuff like that. And I'm also that for others. And so that's been a big change in my life too. And I would say, honestly, that in my entire life of being on this earth for 51 years, this is the time that I've had the best friends and the best community. So.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, you know,
I'm very grateful.
Friends and community can get in the way of your using and drinking.
Right, imagine that. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to. Yeah, I was talking with some people the other night about. We were talking about caring and sharing. Primarily caring about people coming into the program and sharing our experience, strength, and hope with them. You know, to try and help them work along. And you know, I reflected on. You know, back in the day, my drinking days, I was not into sharing, especially not my liquor. You know, if I spent my hard-earned last few dollars on a quart bottle of vodka, sure as hell was not going to, you know, be one of these guys that hung out in the corner and passed the bottle around. That was not going to happen, you know. Mm-hmm. I go home, sit in the garage, and, you know, drink to my heart's content. It's so weird though when you see people like this just happened this last week. A friend of mine got a call from there's like an 800 number you can call for AA and it'll connect you with a member somewhere and hopefully you know he like where's a meeting or can I get a ride and this was one of those can I get a ride and. The fellow they called me because it was like his date night with his wife. So he's like, can you handle this? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And so he goes, okay, the guy's name is Fred, we'll say. And here's his phone number. I'm like, okay. So I call Fred up. And it's, you know, Fred's a pretty common name. And there are a lot of Freds around the program that I've met. But, you know, I'm like, okay, this guy's obviously new to the program. Called the 800 number. Who knows? Hopefully he's sober. And I call this guy up and start talking to him. I'm like, man, this guy's voice is familiar. And I'm like, are you the Fred that had the green Taurus that you blew the engine up on? And now he goes, yeah. And I go, well, you know, I'm Johnny. I remember meeting you down at the LRC, and you were like trying to sell some CDs or DVDs or something, get some bucks to get. He goes, yeah, that was probably me. And I said, yeah, I know who you are. You'll recognize me when you see me. And of course, you know, he was looking for a ride to the Friday meeting. I'm like, yeah, for sure. I'll pick you up at 7. And so I went out and picked him up. He just lives out on the edge of town there, down off Palouse River Drive. And I went down and picked him up. He goes, oh, yeah, I remember you, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just caught up a little bit on the last couple of years and why he hadn't been going to meetings and blah, 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 and whatnot. And now we're, you know, kind of getting together. I'm helping him out with rides when I can. And nice. Encouraging him to, you know, get phone numbers and, you know, lean on some people. It's okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like we're living in the San Francisco Bay Area,
right,
where
a small
guy
town.
From San Jose wants to come up to a meeting in Oakland and somebody's, right. you know, got to be willing
hour.
To
yeah.
drive that, you know, 45 minutes to mm-hmm. an hour down
and back
and back
yeah.
and down and back, you know, to get them to a meeting. It's a friggin' Moscow and Pullman. It's a 15
right.
minute drive in any direction to get anywhere.
Right.
You know,
or
even
five.
I mean, I've gone and picked guys up in Potlatch and they thought that was a huge deal. And I'm like, dude, this is like driving down the street in California. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
yeah, I was just in Portland traffic over the weekend and man. Oh, yeah. I lived. It was fine. I grew up in the Valley of the Sun. So, but at least there I would know when I needed to get off the freeway and like, you know, go through town or something like that. This, I was just kind of subject to, okay, this is what MapQuest is saying. I need to go on this
right.
interstate and then I got to wait in this lane because I got to get onto this interstate. And it's, you know, it's literally 4 miles down the road and we're crawling, but I have to stay right here because it's back to back, you know? Oh.
Yeah. Once I get over, I'll never get back.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, no, I get that. I totally get that. Yeah, I've been in traffic situations like that where it's like, man, there's nobody in that HOV lane. I mean, I could just buzz over there and do a few miles, but how am I going to get back across the 4 lanes mm-hmm. of stopped traffic? You know, that and the State Patrol is not going to understand that I just, you know, needed to get somewhere a little quicker. Although most of the time when I travel anymore, you know, it's my wife and I together, so we're a legal, you know, two-person thing. But still, that doesn't make up for that just waiting in traffic to get over. You know, traffic is one of those places where it's really hard for me to be understanding and considerate of others. It's like when you're at a stoplight and there's like 10 cars at the stoplight, and the second it turns green, some idiot 5 cars back lays on the horn like that's going to get things to move any faster.
Yeah,
you just want to put your car in park and walk back to the sound of the horn
yeah.
and just kind of try and drag him out through the partially open window. So anyway, I mean, but that's all madness I don't have to deal with anymore. In Moscow, like I talk to people about how they talk about, well, do you have traffic jams in Moscow? And I say, you know, once in a while we'll have 3-4 cars at the light and you might have to, you know, wait a minute.
About 4 o'clock. There can be a little traffic around 4.
Yeah, there can.
Yeah.
But again, you know, compared to your adventures
like
in Portland,
it's nothing like that. Yeah.
Well, listen, you ended on the high note there, the traffic note, and we can all reflect on amends we have to make to all those people we flipped off and whatnot on the road. And thanks, Denise, for sitting in, having
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, just in case any of you don't know, my name's Denise, and I am a recovery coach here at the Lake Tahoe Recovery Center. And all the things that we just talked about, I'm here, and I'm available to help you work on any of those things.
That's right.
Well, and I will say the counselor part where you're, like, working on things, you know, like, we can get you a referral for a counselor. Like, we can help you find a counselor,
right.
And they may be available to make an appointment, or you may have to get on a list, but we can at least explore the options in our area.
That's right. That's right. We have the capacity to make all kinds of referrals. Yeah. And we work with some pretty good organizations around here. So, yeah, come on down. Check it out. Well, thanks for that reminder, Denise.
And thanks, Johnny.
I will close it out with my very old, very tired usual, which is if you think you have problems with addiction or behavioral health issues, you do.